Welcome back to the program. Back in 2008, my guest, David Sheff, wrote a book that has become a landmark in our understanding of addiction. Beautiful Boy was his powerful and personal story of the battle he fought alongside his son Nick, who was addicted to alcohol and various drugs. The book catapulted David Sheff into becoming one of the country's most prominent and sane voices on the subject of addiction, not as a doctor or an addict or an academic, but as a father with real-world experience. Now he takes a broader view of what we as a society are doing right and wrong in dealing with the alarming and still growing rates of addiction in this country. It is my pleasure to welcome David Sheff to the program to talk about his newest work, Clean, Overcoming Addiction and Ending America's Greatest Tragedy. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here. It seems that it's impossible to have a conversation about drugs and addiction and public policy without going back 40 years to Richard Nixon in 1971 and the declaration of the drug war, which really changed everything in how we think about this.
It did. We had this, it sort of grew out of this crazy time when initially drug use was treated for what it is, which is a health problem. It was in the domain of doctors and, you know, physicians who were studying this stuff, but then it became a criminal problem. And because of that, for the last 40 years, we've been treating this wrong. And it's because of the war on drugs, drug use has just increased deaths. Right now, we lose more people because of drugs overdoses than any other non-natural cause, 350 people a day. And because we're trying to treat this as a criminal problem, drug use goes underground. You know, we sort of target one drug, and you know, people who are addicted to drugs, who want drugs, will find them. So our strategy isn't working, and now, finally, you know, 40 years later, I'm hoping that we can shift things.
How did we get so muddled in our moral understanding about all of this?
The problem with drug use is drug addiction is a disease. I mean, we know that. The scientists have shown us that. But the problem is that it doesn't look like other diseases, because when someone takes drugs, it appears to be a choice. And, of course, the first time, you know, it is a choice. But what happens is, you know, 10 kids go out and smoke pot or drink on a Friday afternoon or Friday, you know, at a party, and 9 of them probably go on and use drugs moderately or stop or but one of them becomes addicted, and the reason that that person becomes addicted is that they have a brain disease. They have their neurological system processes chemicals differently. If that's not stopped, if the progress of that problem isn't stopped very quickly, the brain, you know, the part of the brain that normally would be all about, you know, moderation and helping, you know, make control decisions that we all rely on to function every day, that part is sort of put on the back burner. It's not operative. And the part that is all about impulsivity and sort of this reckless pursuit of pleasure is in control. And so addicts do things that they would never, ever do if they weren't ill. I mean, that's, you know, addicts rob, they steal. My son, you know, broke into our home. There was a warrant out for his arrest. So we judge people by their behavior. And it looks like they're making a choice. And so we're in this vicious cycle. You know, we treat it as if it's a bad choice. These are bad people. So it goes underground. They don't talk about it. We don't talk about it. Families don't talk about it. And the problem gets worse and worse and worse until it actually leads to this bad behavior. And then that, you know, that cycle continues. If, on the other hand, we recognize that this is a disease, and like with every serious illness, we want to stop it as quickly as we can, it wouldn't progress to the behavior that that is what causes the stigma in the first place.
One of the things that seems to make it so much more complicated is that in many cases it's not the addiction itself that's the disease, but there is some mental illness going on, some disease going on, that the addiction is a kind of self-medication for.
It's true. I think that, you know, the experts say anywhere from, I got different statistics, 60% all the way up to about 80% of people who become addicted have other problems, have other mental illnesses, psychiatric problems. So it makes sense. If you're a kid and you have depression, and no one has caught it, or if you have bipolar disorder, or, you know, even if it's not a psychiatric illness like that, but, you know, cognitive problems like, you know, learning disabilities or attention problems, you know, you take drugs, they get high, and suddenly they feel better. They're not so plagued by whatever it is, by this mental illness, you know, this depression. Well, eventually, you know, drugs actually make those problems worse. But in the meantime, addiction can begin right then because there's this attempt, as you described it, to self-medicate, to treat this problem. And in the meantime, you know, drug use continues, and so the problem is hidden, and it gets worse. The drug use gets worse, and it, you know, the mental illness gets worse, and then it worse, then the drug use gets worse, and both of them are harder and harder to treat over time. So it's just, you know, which is another reason why it's so important for us to pay attention, to catch the early signs and to seek treatment right away.
Which is counter to what a lot of policy and a lot of misconception has been about, that people have to hit bottom before, in fact, anything can be done.
There's been, in the same period of time that you described earlier, so for the past 40 years, even longer actually, this idea that, you know, when you, an addict has to hit bottom if he or she's going to ever get well. And it's just not true. It's the facts are that anybody who goes into treatment for any reason has the same chance of being getting clean and staying clean. But the longer we wait, there's two problems with that. I mean, if we're waiting for someone to hit bottom, the most dramatic and problematic piece of that is that, you know, there's so much of it. Now, somebody told me recently, and this is a man who had tried to help his son over and over again, and his son ended up overdosing and dying. He said that over the course of this, you know, horrendous couple of years, people kept telling him that his son had to hit bottom, and if his son didn't stay in treatment or didn't stay sober, it was because he hadn't hit his bottom. And so when his son died, he said, well, you know, has he hit his bottom now? I mean, it's too dangerous for us to wait. And also, the longer we wait, the worse the problem is getting, and so it's harder and harder to treat. So, you know, we have to reject this idea of hitting bottom. We have to get help as soon as we can, use whatever methods we can to get into treatment, whether it's ourselves or whether it's someone we love, whether it's, you know, just pleading and sort of loving interventions to more serious, you know, sort of traditional interventions. We have to get someone into treatment, you know, right away.
There's an irony in this need to hit bottom, because in many cases it creates situations where the addict is seeking the drugs, resorting to criminal behavior to do that, and pushing the issue back into the criminal justice system where we don't want it to be.
You're exactly right. It's part of this cycle. It's part of this hole that we've gotten ourselves into. And it also goes back to this idea that this must be, therefore, some sort of a moral problem, a failure of will or something like that, because what it says is that, you know, a person has to be punished. They have to be so dire as a sinner, sort of thrown out into the desert almost, so that they are, you know, so desperate to be redeemed that they'll do anything. And so, you know, it's you're exactly right, and it makes it worse, and you know, it makes the addicts then, of course, what they end up feeling worse about themselves, and so another way to deal with that shame is with drugs, and so that also compounds the problem.
In the disease model, it's probably best to think of it as an immune system disorder that feeds upon itself as it gets worse.
It is, and it's different than immune, but it does have a lot of characteristics that are similar. The problem is, you know, that the way that the addict's brain processes drugs is essentially the doctors describe it as a switch is flipped inside the brain, and the brain stops functioning properly, and the wiring works differently, so that there is not sort of the restraints on, you know, there's not the moderation. Normally a person's brain sort of the homeostasis is sort of the brain is trying to bring itself back to normal, which means, you know, without the drugs. But when somebody becomes addicted, the brain switches over so that normal for it is the presence of the drugs. And so when drugs are deprived, the brain goes into sort of a shock. It breaks down. Addicts have described it as compelling of a need. It's not a desire. It looks like a desire, but it's as compelling of a need for drugs as we have for breathing oxygen. You know, when we're deprived of air, we will do whatever it takes to get more. You know, we will kick and we will scream and we will struggle. That's what an addict feels like when they're suffocating because they don't have drugs.
How much of the problem and the way we view it has to do with so many of the people that get addicted are people that are at risk to begin with, and in that process of being at risk have created problem situations for themselves even before the drug addiction takes hold?
It's true that, everybody can become addicted. Anybody, you know, we all think, or at least many of us think, that we're immune or our family is immune, that something about us will protect them, their education, our community, whatever it is. But anybody is vulnerable, everybody is. But, you know, some people are more vulnerable than others, and that is because they may have any one of many risk factors, and they include, you know, addiction, alcoholism in a family. So if someone has parents, grandparents, uncles, aunts, whatever it is, there's a higher likelihood that they'll become addicted. Other risk factors are the mental illnesses we described. People with bipolar disorder, depression, anxiety disorders are much more likely to get addicted. People with who've been through trauma, you know, certain people have gone through divorces. You know, their parents divorce and it's traumatic for them, or certainly people who've experienced violence or abuse. I mean, all these different things make it so much more likely that a person is going to become addicted that it tells us something about how, if ever we're really going to be serious about preventing addiction, what we have to do. And it's instead of, you know, waiting till an addict becomes severely addicted and they're experiencing problems that have made their problem worse, they're in jail, their lives have unraveled, they're alienated from their families. If instead we can get in early and recognize whatever it is that's going on, if parents are getting divorced, children need support through that. They need to be helped. If there's a death in the family, whatever it is, counseling, support, once again. If a child has depression, bipolar disorder, any of these mental illnesses, if we can detect them early and get them treated, then drugs won't appear to be a solution and won't become problematic. So it really shifts the way we think when we understand why people become addicted. Once again, it's not a choice. It's a medical problem. It has all these environmental and biological factors that make it more likely that someone's going to have problems in the first place and more serious problems.
What, if anything, have we accomplished with all the drug education that we've engaged in our schools, for example, the Just Say No, the police officers in school, all of the various things that we did, most of which seem to not work?
Yeah, we've had this same sort of, you know, ridiculous $1 billion program that we've spent, you know, over the last decades to lower drug use, and it's done no good whatsoever. And in fact, in some cases, there's evidence that it's actually increased use. The most popular program that's used in high schools across America and middle schools is the DARE program. And it's what they used when I was a kid, and it didn't do any good for me. And right now they show that, that it increases use because it makes use seem, the warnings, the threats seem exaggerated. Kids don't take them seriously. If they don't take them seriously, then they take all warnings. They dismiss all warnings. It also makes drugs use seem more normal. So instead of sort of this just say no, trying to scare kids approach, we have to go back to this idea that most drug use isn't about drugs itself. It's about the underlying reasons. It's about why people use. And so if we can help people, you know, since most drug use begins in teenage years, we have to figure out what's going on with kids. Are they stressed out? You know, how can we help them if they're stressed? Teenagers are naturally impulsive and they're naturally risk-taking. So are there ways that we can make it safer for them to be impulsive and to take risks, you know, with sports or with engagement in, you know, other kinds of intellectual pursuits that make it, you know, sort of, that they get sort of the same kind of thrill, the same kind of charge, the same kind of excitement around. There's a lot we can do, and it isn't being done. And it will change when we start to acknowledge finally that this problem is so big that we can no longer pretend it's not. You know, we're spending, it's not only those 350 people who die every day, but we're spending as a society $420 billion a year on healthcare costs, on criminal justice costs, on lost productivity. And then when we recognize the enormity of this problem and we start to take it on in the same way that we are thinking and addressing problems like whatever it is, obesity, terrorism, I mean, there is as much or more destruction because of addiction than because of any other problem that you can name, and yet we don't treat it. We don't take it seriously. We don't prevent it. But we can, and we have to, and that is sort of, it's time now. It's time people all across the country, I keep hearing from them. I've been traveling a lot, and I'm meeting these families and communities devastated by drugs, and there's this constant theme that I hear and see where I go, and it's people are saying enough, you know, enough hiding in the shadows. You know, they're starting to organize, they're starting to write letters. So I'm hopeful that things will finally change.
Is there a difference in this conversation talking about kids getting addicted versus adult onset addiction?
Yes, it's much rarer for adults to become addicted, and that's important to know because there's a lot of parents out there who sort of have this lackadaisical attitude about teenage drug use. They kind of think, well, some experimentation is fine. You know, it's normal. Kids are going to rebel or they're going to be curious. Some parents, you know, I've heard them talk about the fact that they even want their kids to use drugs a little bit, to drink, just because they want them to learn how to use in moderation so that when they go off to college, for example, you know, they're not going wild and partying and binge drinking. But all the research says that that's a big mistake because people who actually make it, the longer you postpone use, the less likely a person is to have drug problems. And almost every addiction starts when the person is in high school or a high school age. If kids are using, you know, at 12 years old, 13 years old, which so many kids do, their risk of becoming addicted is way, way higher than if they wait to use until they're 17, 18, 19, 20. And if they stop using or if they don't use by the time they're 21, it's very, very unlikely that they'll become addicted. So we want to do everything we can to postpone use. If our kids are starting to use, if we understand that, if we recognize it, if they talk to us about it, or if we find out in other ways, we want to do everything we can to stop them and to help them grow up as healthily as we can.
And this has to do with brain development.
It is. I mean, you know, teenagers, we always think about teenagers as being sort of crazy and impulsive, and, you know, and they are. And part of it is because of all the developmental psychological stuff going on. I mean, it's a big transition from being a child to being an adult. But there also is a biological piece of it, which is, you know, the part of our brain that is about cognitive thinking, rationality, you know, basically sort of the superego, you know, part of us that is what is going to make us function well and make good decisions and be mature, learn how to have relationships to function properly and to have, you know, to just have the kinds of lives that we want for our kids. I mean, unfortunately, that develops much slower than the rear portion of the brain, which is all about, you know, impulsivity and pleasure seeking. It's sort of this primal part of the brain that was, you know, sort of developed first because it was all about survival. It's about, you know, getting berries and reacting, you know, to threats, those kinds of things. Some, you know, when we needed to react, you know, that quickly and function that quickly without that moderation. That stuff is in control as the brain develops, and when teenagers get older, the front part of the brain, you know, kicks in and it develops more, and it's more, there's a balance. The problem with, you know, when teenagers start using drugs and there is that imbalance, drugs make it even harder, even they hamper the development of the front part of the brain even more. And so the rear part, the impulsive part, is in control for longer. And, you know, it's again part of that cycle, why it's so dangerous for kids to be using. They're going to take more drugs because of that impulsivity. The impulsivity is going to stay there longer. They're going to take more drugs, and it's just a cycle that is so destructive.
Is there any difference between drugs and alcohol?
Fundamentally, no. I mean, there definitely are differences between every drug, but alcohol is one drug of abuse, and in some ways people think because, most of us, I mean, I can go out at night and have a glass of wine at dinner or have a cocktail, but my son, who's an addict, can't, and we have this sense in our culture that alcohol is safer. The truth is that it is actually more harmful than many other drugs. It's one of the few drugs that actually can be lethal for someone who is detoxing because it is so toxic. It affects so many different parts of the brain, the neurological system. Other drugs target one mainly. Alcohol targets many. And so we have this false sense that, you know, drinking is okay, it's socially accepted, and it's safer. But the truth is it's not, and people who, alcoholism is one form of addiction. It kills far more people than other drug addictions. So, you know, this idea that it's safer is just wrong.
Why do so many treatment programs fail?
It's because they are rooted in this archaic and destructive paradigm that looks at drug abuse as a choice and as a moral choice, as a bad choice. You know, bad people become addicted. So drug treatment programs often are rooted in this idea that these bad people have to be, they have to be made to understand that they're bad, that they're failures, that they are immoral, and they have to be redeemed, and they have to pray for forgiveness, and they have to pray it's all about contrition. When in fact, you know, this is a disease, and you know, when people have cancer, when people have heart disease, prayer and spiritual programs can help some people, but it's not how we treat diseases. So when you send a person with addiction into a program that is really about spirituality and does not focus on the physical part of this disease, they help some people, but many people are being set up for failure. These are diseases that have biological roots, and so they need treatments that would work, that don't involve choice, that they don't involve contrition, they don't involve prayer. There are all sorts of therapies that exist. There are behavioral therapies, cognitive behavioral therapies. Medications have been shown to help many addicts both get clean and stay clean. We need to rely on the medical model, and the treatment system out there does not. It is changing, but it's changing really, really slowly. And it's responsible for the fact that so many people drop out of treatment, they relapse, and they die.
Why is it that given the scientific information, the evidence-based information that we have today, that, as you point out, 90% of treatment programs are still based on this 12-step idea?
Well, it's because of, old ingrained habits are die hard. And also, you know, there's a lot at stake. I mean, this is a billion-dollar industry, and there are a lot of people who either are there because it's a, you know, sort of a crass motivation. They make money. But even more so, I think it's less about that. I think that most people in the treatment field are very, very sincere. They very much care about patients, and they very much want to help people. But they only know one thing. They've only known one thing that has helped them, and that's the 12 steps, because that was all that was available for so long. And so if it helped me, if it got me sober, it was the only thing that helped me, then it's the only thing that's going to help anybody else. And so there is a fundamentally flawed but pervasive system that it doesn't just offer 12-step work as a choice. Because 12 steps are brilliant. They're profound. They save lives. But they don't work for everybody. So if a program offers them as a requirement, then it fails people. 12 steps should be offered as an option. If it works for somebody, if the 12 steps, if a person embraces them and if it helps them get and stay sober, then it's fantastic. It's ubiquitous. It's free. It's something that people can participate in their whole lives. And people do, and they stay sober for, you know, 6 months, a year, 10 years, 30 years, 50 years. But because so many people are not helped by 12-step programs, we need treatment programs that offer many different kinds of therapies, many different kinds of treatments. And right now, because, as you say, about 90% of the programs are 12-step based, then it's so hard for people to find other programs, and that's why we're losing so many people.
One of the other things you point out is that relapse is pretty common, and that we shouldn't look at relapse as failure, but simply part of the process, regardless of the program.
It's true, but you know, it's complicated too, because this is a chronic illness. It means that as long as it's being treated, it's probable that a person will stay sober. But it's a chronic illness, which means that the vulnerability remains. So that means people can relapse after 10 years, after 50 years, whatever it is. The propensity is there. The addiction, you know, sort of the addiction brain, whatever they, you know, however you want to describe it, is there. So relapse is always a threat, and it is part of this disease. And people often look at relapse as a sign of failure. You know, I've been in treatment, I relapsed, therefore the treatment failed. My child has been in treatment 5 times, he relapsed, therefore the treatment failed. This is a chronically relapsing disease often, and so it's not necessarily that these relapses have failed. It can mean, I mean, that these treatments have failed. It is sometimes looked at as a treatment trajectory, and it can take multiple stays in rehab programs or in outpatient programs, whatever it is. The problem, though, is that every relapse is life-threatening. It is so dangerous. So we must do everything we can to prevent relapse, which is why relapse prevention is one of the most important parts of addiction treatment.
And this is where the compassion versus anger is such a critical part of understanding these kids.
It is. I mean, we have this idea that good kids, you know, don't use drugs and bad kids use them. But we have to remember that these are our kids. And the people who become addicted are our children. And no one chooses to be addicted. It's not anyone's fault that they have this genetic component or if they have this wiring inside their brain that makes them respond to drugs differently than other people. And as long as we're judging them, shaming them, their use is going to stay hidden. They're not going to be open about their problems until it's critical, until it's catastrophic. As long as we judge them, we are going to be throwing them into treatment programs that are about judging them, that are about looking at their problem as if it is this moral failing. When we understand that addicts are sick, that they're ill, that they have this terrible, terrible, but treatable disease, we can stop being angry, we can stop judging them, and we can start looking at them with compassion as if they have any other disease, which is what we would do. If a person we love had cancer, we would feel only compassion and love, and we would do whatever we could to get them into treatment. That's how we have to face addiction. We have to look at people in our families, people we love, our friends, as people suffering from this terrible disease, and we have to do whatever we can to help them get well.
And how's your son Nick doing?
Nick is doing wonderfully, and he says, I mean, people who think that there's no hope just need to look at Nick. I mean, he was in such terrible shape. This summer he turned 30, and there was a time that I was sure that he wasn't going to make it to 21. He was on the streets. He was shooting drugs. He was using methamphetamine and heroin and drinking alcohol and smoking weed and using pills. I mean, everything in combination. And he was just so near death. But now he's been in treatment. Oh, I guess he was in actually about 7 programs. He relapsed often, but over time he progressed, and now he's been sober for 5 years. And it really is a miracle, and it proves that it's possible for anyone to get sober and to stay sober.
David Sheff, the book is Clean, Overcoming Addiction and Ending America's Greatest Tragedy. David, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you so much for talking about this really, really important issue. Have a great one.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.